Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talk to Dr. Wendy Sucker, who is a spokesperson and president for the Coalition of Gun Control, an advocacy group based in Toronto and Montreal. Although it's being buried by louder and simpler controversies like blackface or dual citizenship or who's an insurance broker or not, gun control was supposed to be one of the biggest issues of this current federal election. In some corners, it still is, and it's hard to think of many issues more controversial than whether or not the government should impose further gun control measures. The pro-gun lobby is easy to understand, but what about those advocating for more gun control? Canada's a pretty safe country, right? We've got no Second Amendment here. Let's dig into that. Gun control is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, last week, the movie Joker opened in thousands of theaters across North America, but because of the subject matter and the history of violence at screenings of Batman movies, police and law enforcement agencies were on their guard in case an active shooter seized on the opportunity. Good thing we don't have to worry about that in Canada, right? What if I told you that Canada isn't even in the top 40 of countries with the lowest rate of firearm-related deaths per 100,000 people? In Canada, 2.05 of people here per 100,000 people die because of a firearm. In the United States, that number is 12.21. That's not to say that there's a lot of gun violence in Canada. Not all gun deaths in Canada are committed in the commission of a violent crime. In fact, 3 out of every 4 gun-related deaths in Canada between 2000 in 2016, were suicides. In real numbers, that's 9,876 deaths in a 17-year period out of a total of 13,168 gun deaths. On top of that, about 240 Canadians each year are hospitalized because of the accidental discharge of a firearm, and another 13 are killed because of accidental shootings. Looking at the numbers, you could say that gun control is much more about safety than it is about violent crime, although the Coalition for Gun Control was born out of one of the most violentest of crimes committed with a gun. According to its website, the Coalition was founded in the wake of the Montreal massacre in 1989 to support strategies to reduce gun death, injury, and crime. For almost 30 years, the Coalition for Gun Control has been working to make Canadians safer, and is supported by more than 200 health, crime prevention victims, public safety, women's, and community organizations across Canada. In terms of legislative goals, they are looking for gun licenses for all gun owners, a cost-effective system to track gun sales, a ban on the civilian possession of military-style weapons, and a ban on handgun sales with very limited exceptions. It sounds simple, doesn't it? But there's a lot of political friction between the goals of the coalition and the people who see any new gun control as an expensive infringement on their rights. And then there's the common point of view. This isn't the United States, and mass shootings aren't an epidemic here. And while we have our share of violent crime and gang activity, guns aren't a problem here when compared to south of the border. So what's wrong with that picture? That's one of the many questions I will put to Dr. Sucker on this week's podcast. We talk about what she wants people to know about the issue beyond the headlines concerning crime and why we forget the victims who don't die violently from guns. We also talk about the politics around the debate on gun control, how it's gotten more divisive in the last few years, and why that's not because of the so-called rural-urban divide. We also discuss the election, the way we talk about gun control in the media, and whether we're reticent to talk about issues that inherently make us feel less safe. So I caught up with Dr. Wendy Sucker by phone from her office in Toronto. So Dr. Wendy Sucker, thank you so much for taking my call today.
Sure.
I wanted to start just by having you do a quick sort of description of your group, the Coalition for Gun Control, and sort of what your goals are and how it all got started.
The Coalition for Gun Control was formed after the Montreal massacre almost 30 years ago, mm-hmm. and it's an alliance of a couple of hundred organizations that range from healthcare organizations to women's organizations, suicide prevention organizations, violence prevention organizations, community groups, labor, cities, and so on.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it speaks to just how big this issue is, because I think us in the media sometimes get bogged down in the crime aspect of this, of gun issues and gun violence and people being harmed by guns, but it is a much bigger issue than just violent crime.
Yes, I mean, in fact, there are more suicides with firearms than there are homicides, for example, with firearms.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's, you know, not to get into the naked politics of this, but I mean, it does seem like that is all we talk about, and it could be said on both sides of the border that, you know, when we talk about gun control, it's only in the context of crime, and does that make maybe your job as an advocate harder, because there's this one, the smaller aspect of the crime that sort of eats up all the attention, as opposed to the bigger aspects of, like, self-harm, people using guns to harm themselves?
Well, you know, we advocate for, and so do many in public health, the idea of a public health approach to gun violence. And if you look at the World Health Organization, for instance, it has a broad umbrella under which it considers violence. So they would include not just criminal violence, but obviously violence against women, which is quite a different phenomena, right, and often gets ignored. Political violence, which would include, you know, attacks on mosques and diverse groups, which we've seen a lot of around the world. It would also include violence against the self, or self-harm and suicide. And it's important, to me, gun violence is like cancer. There are different forms.
Right.
And so there's no one solution to dealing with what is a very complex problem.
Right. And maybe this speaks to the politics of it, too, that, you know, we tend to think, or maybe, again, this is the way the issue is covered, too, that it's all about banning or not banning.
Yeah, I think that the approach to harm reduction looks at gun violence in exactly the same way you would look at cancer. So you would look at addressing the root causes. Mm-hmm. You would look at detection and risk reduction. You would look at treatment and responses. And that works very well whether we're talking about motor vehicle crashes or we're talking about gun violence. So that, you know, when you talk about gun violence, you want to address the root causes of violence. You want to reduce the risk of severity and death, and you want to make sure there's appropriate responses from the justice system, as well as support for victims to prevent re-victimization. Even if you look specifically at regulation and risk reduction, it's important to recognize that licensing and tracking rifle and shotgun owners is critically important if you're concerned about suicide prevention and domestic violence,
right,
whereas banning handguns is much more relevant in the context of urban violence.
Right. It's like, it sounds a bit like dealing with vehicle collisions. You know, it could be because someone is drinking and driving. It could be because someone was distracted driving. It could be because someone was speeding. There's no one cure-all, I guess, to lower vehicular collisions and those casualties as well.
That's a really good analogy. And we have a combination of measures. So, for example, there are strategies around reducing the risk that older people will injure themselves or others, and we've instituted all kinds of controls to retest people, for example, as they're aging. We've ratcheted up the restrictions on drunk driving. We've increased enforcement. We've installed speed bumps and cameras, etc., etc. And nobody thinks that any one thing will solve motor vehicle crashes.
Right.
Everyone recognizes that it requires investments in many dimensions of the problem, and my view is the same is true of guns.
Yeah. Having said that, too, though, I don't think there's, a political divide. I think we all come together on sort of talking about what the solutions are to having fewer car crashes is. And that does not exist in the case of how do we have fewer shooting fatalities. Why is the issue so political?
I think the issue is political, frankly, because you don't really have the... Well, you would have some organizations that may not be fully aligned. So, for example, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers may have different positions than the Canadian Automobile Association may have different positions than General Motors. But I think the difference with firearms is, frankly, spillover effects of the NRA and the fact that, the Canadian gun lobby is much more powerful and, frankly, in my view, irrational than people understand. And the fact you have, for example, the Ontario Hunters and Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters fighting a ban on handguns and military assault weapons speaks volumes about how this really isn't a debate about facts or even the utility of firearms. It's very ideological.
Yeah, and you make this point on the Coalition's website. Nobody is going out into the woods to hunt duck or deer or what have you with a handgun or heaven forfend, an assault rifle. The meat would be useless in the case of the latter. I feel like part of this is driven, and, maybe there's some sort of, I don't know how to phrase it, but, maybe a contact high from the United States, where the gun lobby is a very influential force. It's just weird, though, because we don't have any right to bear arms enshrined in our Constitution. So it feels like, there's maybe something lost in translation, at least for me as sort of like a political person, that, this the whole idea in the United States with the Second Amendment, it's very particular to the United States, and it doesn't necessarily translate here, but we do have these gun advocates, as you said, who act very much like it is enshrined in our Constitution, like we have a Second Amendment of our own, and are making similar arguments to the NRA. The so-called slippery slope principle of gun control. But I guess I'm curious, is in your travels, how does that translate across the border? Because we don't have that tradition in our Constitution that, everybody has a right to.
Well, we don't, but yeah. We do have the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights. We have politicians, frankly, across all political parties that talk about gun owner rights, and we have been unable to restore the provisions that were introduced by Pierre Elliott Trudeau in 1977, because of the pushback by the gun lobby. So I agree with you. There is no right to bear arms. The Supreme Court has said that repeatedly. Firearm regulation is federal responsibility. We have, we've fought all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada to get that clearly defined. Regulating firearms, requiring licensing and tracking of guns does not prohibit their reasonable use. And we had Canadians marching in solidarity with the kids from Parkland calling for a ban on the AR-15 in the United States, not knowing that the AR-15 is sold as a restricted weapon in Canada. So, I have said that gun control was probably the first post-truth issue. The facts don't matter. It's all about politics. And our biggest problem, frankly, is not just that the gun lobby is well-resourced and very vocal, and that there are still a lot of good old boys in Parliament, but that people who support gun control are not really well informed and certainly don't take action. And, you know, Ken Price, whose daughter Samantha was shot at the Danforth incident, and she survived, but, you know, he said quite honestly he had never thought about gun control until he was in the emergency ward with his daughter. So most people who support gun control will say they support it in polls, and we know the polls have been consistent on this for 30 years, whether we talk about banning assault weapons, banning handguns, or regulating firearms, will say they support gun control, but they don't do anything about it. And the 8% of Canadians who own firearms, and it is only 8%, will vote based on it, will donate based on it, will advocate based on it, and will launch very personal, nasty campaigns aimed at people who dare speak in favor of gun control. So the situation is, in my view, very discouraging.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you've been at this for a long time in terms of advocating for more gun control. Am I right? It's not.
Well, the Montreal Massacre's 30th anniversary is this December 6th.
And so, I gather that's what kind of energized you. Am I right about that?
Yep.
Yeah.
But I had worked at the Ministry of Transportation and Communications in highway safety, so I was really well aware of the controls that were in place to prevent motor vehicle injuries and fatalities, and that's why I was horrified when I actually started digging into the state of gun control in Canada.
You're telling the story about that father who hadn't thought about gun control until he was in the emergency room with his child. It strikes as something that occurred to me in preparing for this interview, and a lot of issues, frankly, that I find that people maybe don't want to talk about things that make them feel unsafe. And Canada is a relatively safe country, even in, you know, urban areas where there is maybe more violent gun crime. But is this maybe part of our disconnect that, you know, it's harder to talk about things that, you know, make us feel unsafe because, you know, even if that's rational or not?
You know, I'm not sure. I haven't thought about that. I have to think about that some more. I actually think that the big problem we have is that Canadians compare themselves to the U.S., and they pat themselves on the back, and they think, you know, every time there's a mass shooting in the U.S., they go, tisk, tisk, the Americans should do something about gun control.
Right.
And certainly compared to the U.S., we look great, but we have the fourth highest rate of gun death in OECD countries. You know, the United Kingdom had about 30 gun murders last year, and they have twice as many people as we do. And so I think partly our problem in Canada is we compare ourselves to the U.S., which is the most violent industrialized country in the world, instead of setting our sights higher and looking at European examples or New Zealand or Australia. So people just don't understand how bad things are here until, someone in their family is killed or injured. Or, you know, we have a lot of support from frontline workers as well who deal with these issues on a daily basis.
Have we gotten more divided on this over the years? There's a lot of discussion about how, you know, partisan politics have, you know, hardened and, you know, we're more distant from each other in a partisan sense. There, you know, there's not a lot of the middle ground anymore. And it seems to me that maybe gun control is one of these issues where it's most pronounced. Is that your experience?
I think it has become a wedge issue. Remember Brian Mulroney and Kim Campbell, as his justice minister, introduced legislation in 1991 that, compared to today, looks pretty good. And in the Senate, Nathan Nergetz, who was a conservative senator, said they should have gone further to register guns. Fast forward to when Jean Chrétien was in power and Alan Rock was his justice minister, they introduced C-68, which strengthened licensing, banned short-barreled handguns and some assault weapons, and required registration of all firearms. It was Gerard Baudouin, again a conservative senator, who moved amendments to basically gut the legislation, and then with a number of other conservative senators, including women and senators from Quebec, voted against them. So it was actually conservative senators who cast the deciding votes to get the liberal legislation through in 1995. You don't see that now. The lines are very, very tightly drawn. And Stephen Harper, even, when he was an MP, voted in support of the registration of all firearms at first and second reading because he was representing Calgary and his constituents thought it was a good idea. So I think it has become much more ideological, and it's, in my view, incredibly unfortunate that it's being used as a wedge issue, because often the proposals that are being brought forward are not not what they would be if you had more focus on public safety.
Right. And it's not a rural-urban divide. I think this is like a myth of this debate, is that the people in more rural areas are less open to gun control than people in urban areas. There's actually, and this is shown on your website, there's actually fairly widespread support, majority support, for taking more action on gun control.
Absolutely, because women vote too, and that's what they forget, is there is a gender divide on this. So certainly in rural communities there are more gun owners and there's more opposition to gun control, but even the surveys that look at people who live with gun owners, mostly women, tend to support gun control. And the other big myth is the notion that guns are a problem in big cities. Certainly the numbers in Toronto are high, but on a per capita basis, there are higher rates of gun crime in rural Canada than there are in urban Canada, because there are more guns. The rates of suicide in Alberta have tripled in the last few years as the economy has worsened, partly because 60% of households in Alberta have access to firearms. So that's the other dimension of the myth, is that that guns are only a problem in urban centers. And finally, the notion that you need handguns or assault weapons in rural communities any more than you do in urban communities makes no sense at all. So it's I do think that there's a lot of rhetoric, and there's a lot of assumptions that are a result of huffing and puffing and noise rather than evidence and fact.
Right. And of course, too, most of the majority of the nation's media is based out of Toronto, and some in Vancouver and Montreal too, so that tends to draw the eye of the people covering these issues too.
Absolutely. There are also things like domestic violence still remains something that is viewed as unavoidable, and so a random shooting in a downtown venue will attract media attention for weeks and weeks, and yet a triple homicide won't.
Right. I do want to talk about the election a bit, because the Liberals made a very big announcement about their intentions to introduce more gun control, banning military assault weapons, not bringing back a long gun registry. That's a very powerful third rail. Giving more power to cities to sort of enforce the laws. I gather you have some thoughts.
Well, if You know, Jack Layton proposed gun-free zones in cities in 1991. Mm-hmm. Jagmeet Singh proposed banning guns in cities a couple of years ago. Our position is we need a national handgun ban, mm-hmm. period. Investments in primary prevention, certainly important. And I think, you know, a number of parties have said that they will commit to investing in youth and trying to prevent urban violence. And we've been arguing for a ban on military assault weapons since 1990. But that, of course, could have been done through ordering council.
Right.
So I think I have more questions about the positioning around gun control going into this election than anything else. I'm just not very clear on what is intended or how it will be implemented.
Right. It does seem like it's more of that wedge politics we were talking about. It's good for, you know, just for Justin Trudeau to be out talking about it because it's something he can, blow over the head with Andrew Scheer. You know, it's more of a chance to stoke that partisanship.
Yeah, I think that probably is the case. I didn't think gun-free zones were workable, feasible, or a good idea in 1991, and I just don't think there's any evidence to suggest that they are an effective strategy to deal with the problems of gun violence, because cities have open borders unless you're going to surround them with a wall or a moat.
Yeah.
I don't think it will stem the flow of illegal guns. And cities, you know, we fought to the Supreme Court of Canada to retain jurisdiction federally over this because we know from U.S. examples that patchwork solutions don't work, and municipalities don't have criminal law power, so they're going to give tickets out for illegal handguns. If they're able to persuade the provinces, it's a good idea. And with mostly conservative governments at the provincial level, it's hard to see how that would work. So, like I said, a lot more questions than anything else at this stage.
Yeah. Having said that, too, are you worried about maybe this issue going away? Because I mean, not that it would go away entirely, but there's a lot of attention right now because there's been a lot of gun violence. Again, that's not the end-all be-all of the issue, but, you know, it's been a very busy summer in Toronto for the police service there in terms of shootings. And in terms of there's an election right now, a lot of attention gets put on a variety of issues. What are you worried about, you know, or are you worried about this going away or going back on the back burner once the election's over?
You know, in 2006, there were around 340,000 restricted handguns in Canada. Mm. Now there are a million, almost. The issue is not going to go away because the more they delay and the more firearms proliferate, the more shootings we will see, the more dead children, and the more tragedies where people, you know, shed a tear and say, how could this happen? The answer is, you didn't take action when you could have.
So, I mean, looking at the issue, there is the support out there, but, you know, we've talked a lot about how people maybe don't understand the issue as well as they could. So, what is your advice to people who maybe listen to this or you know, are, you know, just passing through and they see something on Facebook one day and, you know, in terms of like, how do they get educated about the issue? Where's, you know, how can people begin to get better informed on this?
Well, it's not that complicated, right? The evidence is pretty uniform around the world. Where you have more guns, you have more risk that people will misuse them. And so, you know, having strict controls doesn't prevent people from using firearms for legitimate purposes, hunters, farmers. I think we've reached the point in Canada where there's pretty strong support for the idea that hunting, that collecting and target shooting are nice hobbies, but represent too much of a risk. And,
right.
you know, 2/3 of Canadians want to see a complete ban on handguns and assault weapons. I think the issue, you know, there's lots of material people can read in the media. I think the bigger issue is making your voice heard, making sure that MPs know that you care about this, raising it with your with the candidates when they come to the door. In Toronto, it seems that it is an issue that is getting raised, but in other parts of the country, not so much. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, I don't want to seem all doom and gloom, but had Paul Martin proposed a ban on handguns in 2006, mm-hmm. and had he proceeded, even if they had simply banned the import and sale, right, not taken anybody's guns away, but just banned the import and sale of firearms, we would have about 340 restricted handguns in Canada. Now we have close to 1 million. If we wait another 4 years, it'll be 2 million. And, you know, you reach a tipping point where you simply can't turn back the clock. And I think Canadians really need to understand that there is a sense of urgency around this, and tears and flowers are just not enough.
Dr. Wendy Sucker, thank you so much for lending your time and your advocacy to me today. This was a good conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, that was Dr. Wendy Sucker, and you can learn more about the Coalition for Gun Control at their website, guncontrol.ca. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from our host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast, you will also get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Friday. You can get in touch with me by email, adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. Check out Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be an episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.